Here we go. Thank you. Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the regular meeting of the California Regional Water Quality Control Board, Lahontan Region. My name is Pete Pumphrey, and I am the board chair. I'm going to kind of short-circuit things in terms of the introductions this afternoon, because the first thing that we're going to do is go into closed session. And we'll be in closed session for three items. Discussion of litigation, Fox Capital Management Corporation versus Lahontan Regional Water Quality Control Board, El Dorado Superior Court Case, SC 201170189. And this is pursuant to Government Code Section 11126, Subdivision E. Second item is discussion of litigation, Seven Springs Limited Partnership versus Lahontan Regional Water Quality Control Board, El Dorado County Superior Court Case Number SC 201180 61. Authority for that is Government Code Section 11126, Subdivision E. And lastly, we will be involved in a discussion of personnel matters pursuant to Government Code Section 11126, Subdivision A. I contemplate that we will, when we're through with closed session, we will probably take time out to have dinner, and board members will probably have dinner, and then we will reconvene here at 6 o'clock and take up the agenda as is noticed. I know that there was an indication on the agenda that we were going to have public forum, board member reports, and executive officers reports perhaps before the dinner break, but I just don't think that's a realistic thing to hope that we're going to accomplish. I would rather not have people come back just to be told that we didn't finish in a timely manner to get those things done, and then be forced to push dinner off and throw the schedule in the evening off. And I know we have people who are coming for board agenda items at 6. So I think that we will do closed session and then reconvene at 6 o'clock, come out of closed session, even though we have had our dinner break, and then proceed with the agenda. So that having been done, we are now in closed session. I would ask that members of the public, staff members, etc., please leave the premises, the room. I guess if you left the premises, you'd actually have to get in your car. So. Good evening. We earlier were in closed session. There is nothing to report from that closed session. So, good evening, members, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the regular meeting of the California Regional Water Quality Control Board, Powhatan Region. My name is Pete Pumphrey, and I am the board chair. I want to thank you for coming to our meeting. We welcome your comments, ideas, and participation because they help us to do a better job. At this time, I would like to introduce the other board members of the regional board who are here with us in Barstow. To my left, Keith Diaz from Rosamond. To my right, Dr. Amy Horn from Truckee. I would also like to introduce the board members attending in South Lake Tahoe via teleconference. I don't know if they're to my right or my left. I know that they're to my north. Don Jardine from Markleyville.
Here.
Eric Sandell from Truckee.
Of course.
Excellent. The executive officer is Patty Kuyumjin. Ms. Kuyumjin, would you please introduce the staff who are with us this evening?
Yes, Chairman Puff would be happy to. But to my left is Elizabeth Barrett, our legal counsel, and Katrina Fleshman, who is our board clerk. Also with us in the audience is Scott Ferguson from our Tahoe office, Patrice Copeland from our Victorville office, Jaheel Cass, again, from our Victorville office. We have David Boyers from the State Water Board, who has joined us today. And since I can't see our staff up north, I'm going to ask even a board member or if one of our staff, Ben Letton or Rob, would help us introduce staff up there in Tahoe.
You have Rob Tucker, myself, and Mr. Ben Letton, a division manager for some of the units up here.
Thank you. The regional board will be considering many items during this meeting. Please feel free to comment on any item, so our decision will be based on all available information. We now webcast our water board meetings, and the link can be found on our agenda. If you wish to speak on an agenda item, please fill out the orange speaker card in the back of the room and hand that card to Katrina Fleshman, our board clerk. Please respect the board members, staff presenters, and your fellow citizens. Everyone's views should be heard. If a lot of people wish to speak, I may place time limits on presentations. If you have any written materials as part of the agenda item, please hand copies to Katrina Fleshman and she will distribute them. So that we may have an accurate administrative record, please speak after I call your name and invite you to come to the lectern. Please communicate your ideas clearly and efficiently. Cases of novel coronavirus, COVID-19, have been detected in California. The Water Board is proceeding with today's meeting and asks that participants follow basic precautions to help prevent the spread of this disease. First, if you have an undiagnosed fever or symptoms of respiratory illness, please consider seeking medical care. Please consider viewing the meeting on our webcast. If you are only interested in specific items on the agenda, please consider leaving the meeting room until the item is about to be discussed. You can follow along through the webcast to anticipate when the agenda item comes up. Third, members of the audience should refrain from shaking hands and increase their social distance by spreading out throughout the meeting room, leaving at least two seats between you and the person next to you. Now, see, that's written poorly because there should be no person next to you because they should be two seats away. There's nothing in here about enforcement of the two-seat rule, but it's still here. Fourth, cover coughs and sneezes with your sleeve or with a tissue that you dispose of in the trash. Fifth, wash your hands frequently with soap and water for at least 20 seconds or using an alcohol-based hand sanitizer, especially after using the restroom or after blowing your nose, coughing, or sneezing. Next item on our agenda is public forum. Any person may address the Water Board considering a matter within the Water Board's jurisdiction that is not related to an item on this meeting agenda or currently pending before the Water Board. I do not have any speaker card for this item, but is there anyone in the audience who wishes, first of all, in South Lake Tahoe? I guess I can short-circuit some of this by asking if there is an audience in South Lake Tahoe.
Hearing what us chickens, no audience in South Lake Tahoe.
Okay, thank you. Secondly, then, anyone here in the Barstow location who wishes to address the board during public forum? Seeing no one, turn to the next item, which is consideration of adopting the minutes of the regional board meeting of November 20, 2019, which was held here in Barstow, California.
I move that we adopt the minutes from the November meeting.
I'll second the motion.
Mr. Jardine?
Aye.
Mr. Sandell?
Aye.
Mr. Diaz?
Aye.
Dr. Horn?
Aye.
And I vote aye. Also, I should also note for the record that Board Member Kimberly Cox is unable to be with us tonight. Item four, reports by Water Board Chair and Board Members. Anything to report, Mr. Jardine?
No reports.
Mr. Sandell?
We're expecting snow this weekend.
Good. So are we in Bishop. We're actually expecting snow on the ground in Bishop, even, which in March is rather unheard of. So, Mr. Diaz?
No report, thank you.
Dr. Horn?
A quick comment. I've been on this board since 2003, and for most of the time I've been on this board, the board has been very congenial. And I feel in the last couple of years that we have started developing into factions, and I think that that is not a good development, and I hope we can work to overcome that.
I don't have much to report. The vast bulk of the chair's call a week ago Monday was devoted to talking about COVID-19 and how the state and the board, state board and regional boards, are potentially going to respond to that. It's a really fluid situation, as I think everybody knows. And so whatever was good information a week ago is probably no longer good information. Stay tuned, and we will, of course, do the best we can to keep you informed and also try to create the most, the best situation that's conducive to everybody's health. Item five, executive officer's report.
Good evening, Chairman Pumphrey and board members. It seems appropriate after the COVID remarks you just made. I'm hoping to keep my voice here, but it is allergies, not illness, so as to allay people's fear. So see if my voice sticks with me here. Well, again, good evening, Chairman Pumphrey and board members in Barstow, as well as the board members up in South Lake Tahoe. I'm going to update you on 3 months' worth of EO reports. That would be December, January, and February. Our next board meeting will be in Bishop. That will be May 6th and 7th. We've also made arrangements for webcasting from Bishop's in case, again, for the virus or other reasons, people can't participate in Bishop. Let me start with a personnel update and welcome one of our newest supervisors to the fold, and that is Mary Fiore Wagner, who will head up our new non-point source unit. I'll tell you a little bit more about that later when I discuss the org chart that's in our package. We're also recruiting for two specialists, one in the north and one in the south. The one in the south, in Victorville, will handle groundwater issues and be sort of our groundwater monitoring expert, oversee our SGMA program, potentially salt nutrient management plans, and emerging contaminants. The one up north will be replacing Mary Fiore Wagner. Mary had handled, as you recall, she was our regional monitoring coordinator for surface water, climate change, and generally our monitoring expert, and dealt with SinoHabs. So we'll still figure out what that role will be, but we will have someone north and south that will complement each other in terms of specialists. Excuse me. I'm now going to switch to the report, where it talks about the Rosamond Community Services District groundbreaking, which is on base stamp 5-15 of my executive officer's report. I really wanted to highlight this because it was a very positive news for the district to build their new treatment plant for $15 million. They paid for this expansion through cash reserve loans and a DWR grant from Prop 1. The compliance requirements included in the July 2019 WDRs that this board adopted, I think in this room, allow the district to qualify for funding. So if you recall that we updated that permit. So this new plant is going to allow them to treat 1.27 million gallons per day and produce secondary treated effluent that will go into perk ponds. The use of the existing evaporation ponds will cease, as you recall that those ponds had issues, and sludge in the ponds will be removed and disposed of off-site. Discharge to the percolation ponds will provide the district with 1,000 to 1,200 acre-feet of potable water credit under the terms of the Antelope Valley adjudication. So that's all good news. I'm going to shift up north, and let's talk a little bit about Lake Tahoe and what's going on there. There's a report in your packet on bait stamp 5-18. As you recall, we updated our Lake Tahoe Nearshore Protection Plan, and there's a couple of highlights in terms of what we're working on, actually some kind of exciting work we're doing with scientists and others. Specifically, working with Nevada Department of Environmental Protection, as well as our three permittees on the California side, we're doing well on our TMDL program. We're hitting our targets in 2019, and we're on track. We're on track to hit our fine sediment reductions, total phosphorus, and total nitrogen loads. For 2020 as well. We still struggle with nearshore conditions, as you well know, and we have lots and lots of projects underway. We have a lakewide aquatic plant survey to give us more information about invasive species. We have a comprehensive health survey to assess bacteria and cyanohabs. And we're going to expand that human health survey conducted in 2019 and continue that in 2020. We're going to continue our research to understand the drivers of the changing periphyton conditions, which is what we struggle with. And we have two peer reviews with the Tahoe Science Advisory Council to investigate the seasonal clarity problems we've been seeing and evaluate our monitoring methods for algal growth to see if we can improve our methodologies. Excuse me. We're also going to explore the impact of crayfish on the periphyton population. I'm working with Nevada on that one. Hotspots. On the West Shore, I don't know if you recall, we did a big study with USGS a bit ago, where we found that some of the groundwater was causing some nearshore problems. But we did dive a bit deeper into that study, and so we've initiated new work with USGS to take that study further to better understand what is causing that unique situation on the West Shore. We're also investigating climate change influences. UC Davis is helping us look at the nearshore and influences to look at the warming lake water impacts on nutrient and carbon cycling. Of course, all of this will feed into if we need to update our standards or change how we're we're regulating some of the regulated community. We're not quite there yet in terms of making any changes, but that's sort of the intent that this is going to feed into. I'm going to take you down south again now. We're going to talk about PG&E and the Hinkley Compressor Station cleanup, apropos for where we are. We have a June board meeting in this very room on the 10th and 11th where you're going to get your annual report from ourselves, the IRP manager, and PG&E on what has our progress been since last year. I know everyone is excited to find out how the chromium background study is going, so you'll get a bit of a progress update on that from staff and how Dr. Izbecki is doing. A final draft report is being circulated now in the technical working group. There is still a lot of work to be done on it, and we're hoping for a final report to be released by the end of the year or early next year to the public. When that happens, after that happens, then it will come to the board, and we'll give a presentation to the board about the contents of that independent study. The chrome plume boundary, as you know, we get the quarterly maps from them. The second quarter 2019 map lines are showing slight decreases in some areas and slight increases in the other areas. This is normal. We factored this into the permits, into the cleanup and abatement order. These changes reflect natural fluctuation in the plume boundaries as remediation progresses. Like I said, you'll get the full details in June. The annual evaluation of the groundwater monitoring program, if you might recall, we had this interesting flow chart in the back of our cleanup and abatement order allowing PG&E to propose ideas for changing the monitoring regime. They have done that and recommended reducing sampling for some wells, increasing in others, changing frequency. So I report that's all working, and staff are working with them collaboratively, as well as the community also always gets consulted on these kinds of things. I guess I'm going up north again to Leviathan Mine, our very own owned Superfund site. There is a report on bait stamp 5-34. There is an accompanying article, which I won't cover, but is very interesting regarding our staff's visit to a similar Superfund site in Redding. So be sure to read that. Lots of good pictures there. I don't want to cover too much, but I just want to at least report, as you recall, the last couple of snow-filled years, we had trouble emptying our ponds on time. The goal is to, of course, do our spring treatment and have our ponds empty so that they could take the next year's snow and rain. For 2019, we did achieve that task and removed 13 million gallons, or have 13 million gallons storage capacity. So the upper pond is empty. This is how we like it, by the way. As you may recall, we were in negotiation with Atlantic Richfield on early final remedial actions on the main dealing with the acid mine drainage. Those discussions are ongoing. We are talking about an aggressive schedule between us and US EPA to move on that because we're anxious to see if we can get to that. Atlantic Richfield has agreed to a pilot project this treatment season. And so we'll be working with them, and we hope to get a work plan soon. I'm not sure if we received it yet, but we're soon.
Soon.
End of the first quarter. All right, soon. Also in there, you'll see the Arco Seal, nice picture of an office. And for those of you that went on the tour of Leviathan, you saw it was kind of close to the pond. I know we're pretty excited about that, at least staff are, because it's got air conditioning, heat power, satellite phone, internet. I still even remember how excited we were when we got our first porta potty up there, but I think we're even more excited about this. Yeah, we finally have a place to go and a place to be in the winter and the summer, so you know, I don't think you're going to have a housewarming party or opening, but for those that went, you all seen that. I'm just going to mention there was an article on the Truckee accessory dwelling units on Bates Stamp 5-59. I don't want to go into great detail on that because it's a unique situation with Truckee and some decisions that they made and how it affects our basin plan. But in September, you're going to hear all about that because staff will be presenting the board with a workshop on accessory dwelling units, the Truckee issue, and likely statewide, because I'm hearing a lot of issues with our fellow regional boards where certain cities are doing their own efforts with accessory dwelling units, and that's above and beyond or different than the approved county LAMPs. So they're struggling with this statewide. So in September, you're likely going to hear more about this. I just wanted to highlight that for you. I'd like to now talk about the Indian Wells Groundwater Authority. This is on Bates Stamp 5-60. What's in your packet is a report from our staff who went to the recent meeting of the GSA. What I want to mention to you, remind you, this is our only critically overdrafted Sigma Basin in our region. And part of the process is that whenever they present their plan, and they have, that we take a look at it, and we are. DWR manages a portal where they load up all this information, so that it's a good one-stop place if you want to know any information on any of the overdrafted basins in our state. So there's a 75-day comment period. We're in that comment period, which ends May 4th. And we are working on comments ourselves, our staff are. What does it mean to our basin plan? What are the known problems? We'll look at the salt nutrient management plans and potentially our LAMPs and provide comments. We'll be coordinating with the State Water Board when we do so. And we'll be sending those over to the Department of Water Resources and then probably meeting with them afterwards. I will circulate that letter to the board whenever it's completed. I want to talk a little bit about confined animal facilities. There's a very nice report in your packet on Bates Stamp 5-67. We're down to actually only seven active dairies in our region, the three heifer ranch, which is down from when I first got here a couple number of years ago. And many other regions have, like the Central Valley region, have so many more confined animal facilities than we do. Some have a lot of horse facilities, like at racetracks. We don't have a whole lot in our region. But what I just want to summarize for you is, what is our strategy here in our region, particularly with dairies, which are the bulk of what we have. We have a few equestrian facilities here and there, and we have the two big BLM wild horse facilities, one in Ridgecrest, one in Susanville, a little few poultry farms, and an odd ostrich emu ranch, too. But just to cover the priorities, our priorities are to make sure we protect downgradient drinking water receptors, as it always has been. So we have a number of cleanup and abatement orders that are existing, one settlement agreement, and right now we're providing, through those orders, drinking water to 29 residents. The next thing is source control, to help control the source, and that's best management practices, improved ponds, other things. These are things we hope when we prepare our general order for the board's consideration, potentially next year sometime, that we can help address this more uniformly across our region, not just for our existing facilities, but any future ones that should come down the road. One of our third priorities is adequate monitoring. Again, we have spotty monitoring. Some have, some don't. Again, the general order is something we hope down the road to have more consistency in how we handle monitoring for these kind of facilities. Of course, the next rail is groundwater remediation. We're not quite there yet. When we get to that stage, we'll be working with folks individually. But many of our other regions that have large animal operations, particularly in the Central Valley, this is a long-standing struggle for them because it's hard to tell what's caused by one facility as opposed to legacy. So it is actually an issue of statewide concern. There's been legislation introduced on that over the years of how to address that. But I don't have any answers for you yet on that because they're still working on it statewide. I'd like to just mention, I have included in your report the governor's resiliency plan. I just included a subset of recommendations on bait stamp 5-81. This is the draft report that the governor has put out for public comment. The public comment period has closed. And I'm going to, they're grouped into three areas, and I'm only mentioning in this list on bait stamp 5-81, the ones that directly impact the state board or regional boards. There's another list out there, if you're curious, I can get it for you, on what might affect us or indirectly affect us. And then there's a third rail, another list of it's really not within our area. It could be the air board, it could be the Department of Water Resources, another agency. So of the list where it affects the regional board, it really is preventing contamination of groundwater basins. Not to say this list doesn't affect us indirectly and we'll be involved in these discussions with the state board, but some of these tasks the state board is lead on. And again, this is the draft list, so it could change when the final report's out. The other one I'd like to highlight is implementing a new law on harmful algal blooms. Our region is slated to get one more position. I'm hopeful we will get that because it'll make a big difference in our region if we do get that position. Another one is support mercury control programs. As you heard staff maybe an earlier one update you, we are going to be starting with the tribal beneficial uses objectives, that involves mercury, so I just wanted to highlight that. And there's a lot on in-stream flows, which I think is kind of exciting because they're working on some methodology at the state board and talking about instead of having a two-step process of the regional boards doing their in-stream flows and then going over to the water rights world and working with them, that doing more of a cohesive work together approach with the regional boards and the state board. It's still in the early discussion stages of what that might look like, and some of that you'll see is the rapid methodologies that they're working on for flow metrics and some other things. So stay tuned. I think there'll be a lot of more exciting news on that that I think will help regional boards. I also, at this juncture, because it's somewhat related but not, I will mention our bacteria objective project that you know is our highest priority in the triennial review. We released an announcement last week of workshops. Those will be the third week in March, and they'll be in Mojave, Bishop, South Lake Tahoe, and Susanville. So we'll have workshops up and down the state to talk to stakeholders. So it's the board's highest priority, and we're staff are really doing some great work on implementing that. I want to now, I did whet your appetite by talking about Mary Fiore Wagner and changes, so I'm going to have you look at bait stamp 5-85. Our organization is growing. We received three wildfire positions to help us with transmission line and the new laws regarding wildfires and harvesting and other things. So we've done a slight reorganizing of our org chart to fit our needs, to fit the workload and the priorities that we have. A lot of these ideas came from the bottom up from our managers and others. So Patrice's unit didn't change very much, so I'm going to leave the South Regulatory Unit alone. The Compliance and Planning Division probably changed the most. It used to have three units. Now it has four, so Ben Lutton up north has a lot more work. Dan Sussman is over our Planning Assessment Unit. A lot of his tasks didn't change, but he now reports to Ben. Eric Taxer heads up our Cannabis Unit. much of his world has not changed. The non-point source world has changed. We have Mary Fiore Wagner over it, over Sino Habs, 319 grants, and grazing, a big one there. All of the Tahoe issues, so instead of one person, you'll have multiple people that'll be helping out on Tahoe, so that's actually a good thing. We'll actually be able to give some attention to Mono Lake, our other outstanding national resource water as well. Mr. Cushman, who is now over our forestry and dredge and fill unit, will again focus his time on the forestry management, utility quarter, and then do our dredge and fill permitting. Mr. Tucker will be heading up our regulatory enforcement unit. So he'll be heading up enforcement, spills, stormwater construction, industrial municipal, wastewater, and miscellaneous permitting. Mr. Brooks will now be over cleanup and site investigation, which he has been doing an awful lot of work on that already, with the Tahoe and other things, landfills, mines, underground storage tanks, et cetera. Our Leviathan unit remains unchanged. So I just wanted to highlight some of those changes for you. New issues. I spoke to you at one point about the munitions of unexploded ordnances at George Air Force Base, as you recall. I want to report that a fence has gone up. I wanted you at least to know that. A fence is up. There's more work to be done. It's a smaller portion, but we know that's, at least that's where toxics in the military know there are munitions. And we are working with them closely, as with toxics, to do our best to assess the other areas. And as we know there are problems, fences, there's commitment that a fence will go up once we know more. I was going to talk a little bit about the COVID virus, but I don't think we need to, other than to point out that the governor has released an executive order. I do have copies. And it's possible the governor will release another executive order giving us more direction. Board members, do you have any questions of me of this report?
Start with South Lake Tahoe. Mr. Sandell?
I just have one question. Why has it taken an extra year to get the reports done for Hinckley?
An extra year. You mean Dr. Becky?
Yes.
Ah. Partly was the federal shutdown.
That wasn't that long.
That wasn't that long. I think in other thing complexities with it and internal peer review. I'd have to ask the staff specifically why it took so much longer, but it is taking longer.
It's not done yet.
No, it's not done yet. I think it's being more, it's more complicated than thought. I know there was additional work that Dr. Becky had to do, but I can't answer specifically what that was that added time.
But perhaps you could include that in an XPO report. It'd be interesting.
Yes, I could provide the board with an update on Dr. Becky and his timeline.
Mr. Jardine?
No questions.
Mr. Dias?
Good presentation, Patty. I do have one question on your org chart. Is Jan Zimmerman now responsible for PG&E Hinckley, or is she always?
That's been transitioning to her before the org chart, and okay. Actually, we just got a new position for benefits of our friends at PG&E added to Jan's unit to assist with that work. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you. No more questions.
Dr. Horn?
I have no questions. Thank you.
I have no questions either. Thank you very much.
Thank you, everyone.
Item 6. The Water Board will consider whether to accept or reject a proposed settlement agreement entered into by the Board's prosecution team in the city of Victorville. The board or advisory team may ask questions pertaining to the proposed settlement at any time. Members of the prosecution team include Laura Drabant from the State Board's Office of Enforcement and Scott Ferguson, supervising Water Resource Control Engineer. Members of the advisory team include Patty Kuyumjin, Executive Officer, Elizabeth Barrett, Water Board Counsel, and joining us from the South Lake Tahoe office are Ben Letton, Supervising Engineering Geologist, and Rob Tucker, Senior Water Resource Control Engineer. Consideration of the proposed settlement is not an adjudicatory proceeding, and the board will not be considering evidence presented by the parties. As a result, no oath will be administered, and the board cannot adjourn to closed session to deliberate on the proposed settlement. Our order of presentation, begin with the prosecution team, City of Victorville presentation, any comments from the public, and then board questions and discussion. Ferguson.
Good evening, members of the board. My name is Scott Ferguson. I'm a supervising water resource control engineer. I'm also the division manager of the division that includes our Leviathan Mine Unit, our Regulatory and Enforcement Unit, and our Cleanup Site Investigation Unit. This evening, I'm here to discuss with you agenda item number six. It's a proposed settlement agreement and stipulation for entry of order addressing multiple sanitary sewer overflows from the City of Victorville's sewer collection system. In following my presentation, I'm going to have Keith Metzler, the city manager for the City of Victorville, come on up, and he has a few words and thoughts that he'd like to also share with you. And then following that, city staff, myself, will all be present and available for questions and answers. Also, before I get going here, I'd like to introduce, Patty already introduced him a little bit, but David Boyers is here. He's Assistant Chief Counsel with the State Water Board Office of Enforcement, and he is pinch hitting for Laura Dravant, who has been part of this effort from the very beginning, but unfortunately could not join us tonight. Okay. So real briefly, my presentation is going to provide some background, what brought us to here tonight, and then I'll go over the settlement agreement terms and provide a little information on those, and then I'll wrap things up with what I believe to be the Water Board's options and what our final request is. So a little background. So the settlement agreement addresses a series of sanitary sewer overflows, nine to be specific, and those occurred from the city's sewer collection system, the first one beginning back in March 2014, or occurring in March 2014. And it was the nature and the causes of these initial sewer spills that caught our attention, caught Water Board's attention, and resulted in a State Water Board, La Hunt and Water Board joint site investigation or inspection and program audit of the city's sewer operation and maintenance program. And following that site investigation or inspection program audit happened December 9th, 2015. And following that, the State Water Board staff produced a report, and in July 1st, 2016, the prosecution team issued administrative civil liability complaint R6V-2016-0042. The ACL complaint identified alleged violations associated with six sewer spills at the time. It also included one alleged violation for failing to quickly and adequately clean up after one of the sewer spills. And it also included an alleged violation for failing to properly manage, maintain, and operate the city's sanitary sewer system. These are all alleged violations of the State Water Board's general permit for public sanitary sewer systems, among other also of state water quality protection laws and regulations. The ACL complaint proposed a liability amount of just over $6.3 million. So shortly following issuance of the ACL complaint, the city waived its right to a public hearing on the matter within 90 days and the prosecution team and the city entered into settlement talks on this matter. During those settlement talks, three additional sewage spills occurred, and those three additional spills were subsequently incorporated into the talks and are part of the proposed settlement before you this evening. It was also during this time that the city provided a substantial amount of new information regarding the incidents and the alleged violations. And from that information, the prosecution team concluded that significant adjustments in the alleged violations, specifically removing violation 7 and 8, and revisions to liability amounts were warranted actions. As a result of the settlement talks, the prosecution team and the city were eventually able to come to agreement of terms, and we released for a 30-day public comment period a proposed settlement agreement and supporting documentations. That was released on November 8, 2019. The only comments, questions that were submitted in response to that during the public comment period were from the Water Board's advisory team. The city and prosecution team responded to those questions and requests for information, and then we subsequently submitted a revised signed set of settlement documents, which are the ones that are before you today. And I just want to let you know that the primary terms between the settlement agreement that was released on November 8, 2019 for public review and what is before you are the same or remain unchanged. So what are those terms? The terms of the settlement agreement include imposing a total liability amount of $1.5 million against the city. Of that total liability, half or $750,000 of it are to be a cash payment to the State Water Board's cleanup and abatement account. The remaining $750,000 are available to implement a supplemental environmental project, or SEP, that the city has proposed and is included in the settlement agreement. It also addresses and resolves the violations associated with the 9 discharge incidents that are identified within the settlement document. So that's the money end of it. Let's talk a little bit more about what the SEP involves. The SEP involves basically is a grant and construction program where the city will connect to the city's sanitary sewer system up to 33 properties in the Old Town area of Victorville. And these properties are currently using on-site septic system leach fields or on-site wastewater treatment and disposal systems. And that discharge to the underlying shallow groundwater. The city will cover the connection and construction cost, in addition to overseeing proper abandonment of the septic systems. And the city is scheduled to complete this project by late November 2021. So that's a pretty short timeline compared to some of our other SEPs. The SEP has several very positive attributes that I'd like to just highlight. The first one I want to touch upon was that this SEP came out of the Lahontan Water Board's SEP program. It was developed in conjunction with one of our SEP partners, that being the Mojave Integrated Regional Water Management Plan Implementation Support Team. So that's our Mojave IREMP at work helping us. They worked with the city of Victorville to put this project together. It was developed by them. It was publicly vetted and approved through their process. And then it came to us for review, and we accepted it into the program. And the added value of that is that now you can have confidence that it meets the criteria spelled out in the SEP policy, the State Water Board SEP policy. And also, it complies and meets the criteria that you have identified as part of your own Lahontan Water Board SEP program. So that process has saved us a lot of time. It still takes time, but we didn't have to go out, start from scratch as we've had to do in the past. develop it, work it, and then in the past, pre-RCEP program, launch it upon everybody for the first time, like 30 days out from the meeting. So we're confident that this will be a good and good project to move forward on. Some other positive attributes. It's going to be improving public and environmental health by reducing the nutrient and pathogen pollutant loading that is to the shallow groundwater underlying the Old Town area of Victorville. And this is also the groundwater that helps support the perennial flows in the Mojave River that are adjacent to the project area and down gradient of the project area. So that's another positive element of the SEP. The SEP is also serving a disadvantaged community as identified by CalEPA's Cal EnviroScreen system. So we're helping out a community that can use a hand up. And lastly, and another goal of both the State Water Board's SEP policy and our SEP program is that there's a very strong nexus between the SEP and what it's going to accomplish and the nature and location of the violations. By that, I mean the discharges that are the subject of this settlement agreement happened within the city of Victorville. The SEP is taking place within the city of Victorville. So there's your strong location connection. With respect to the nature of the violations, we're looking at the discharge of raw sewage that likely in certain cases affected the groundwater, shallow groundwater quality, and the SEP is removing the effects of waste discharges in the Old Town area or reducing them. So basically, the violations added nutrients, pathogens. The SEP is helping reduce those nutrient pathogen pollutants. So there's the connection between the nature of the violation and what the SEP is doing. So we have checked a lot of good positive boxes. You can have confidence that the SEP satisfies the State Board's SEP criteria and your criteria, and I think it's a good fit. So those are the key terms and some additional information on the terms of the settlement agreement. So now I want to just spend a little time about what else went into the decision-making process coming to these terms, and especially the monetary element of it, the 1.5. Another key element of the State Board's enforcement policy and of our enforcement program is that our enforcement actions are consistent, fair, and effective. And in the case of ACLs, the consistency is generally thought to come from using the ACL methodology and using that to calculate a liability amount. In this case, when we went through and we considered all the factors, we came up with a value of about $11.7 million. Substantial amount. So then we're like, okay, are we in the ballpark? Is that similar to what we've done in the past? Is this fair? Is it consistent with past actions? So the enforcement policy does allow us to look at other actions the board has taken to kind of judge, are we in the right ballpark? And that's what we did in this case. And what I looked at was another wastewater related case back in 2007 that involved Los Angeles County Sanitation Districts 14 and 20. It resulted in the largest monetary settlement that this board has been a part of. It was a $4.75 million settlement. A significant part of that went to a SEP. But the overall liability, $4.75 million. And that was for the impacts associated with treated wastewater, secondary treated. In this case, we're dealing with raw sewage discharges. So not completely apples to apples, but pretty close. So I just want to present what went into that, what that $4.75 million settlement addressed to compare it to what we're dealing with today. So we had two wastewater treatment facilities and discharges. One resulted in documented nitrate polluted groundwater over a 2.5 square mile area, the top upper 50 feet of groundwater. Above 10 milligrams per liter nitratous nitrogen, which is the drinking water standard or maximum contaminant level. We also had the other discharge was resulting in nuisance conditions that was affecting the Air Force's ability to use Rosamond Dry Lake as an emergency runway. Also, to give you a little more perspective, and it'll come into play in a moment, one wastewater treatment facility had a treatment capacity of 16 million gallons per day. The other one was 15 million gallons per day. The settlement agreement addressed violations of waste discharge requirements, basin plan prohibition, waste discharge prohibitions, two cease and desist orders, and one cleanup and abatement order. And these violations had been occurring for over a 10-year period leading up to the settlement agreement, and we still are looking at groundwater with nitrate concentrations above the MCL. Now, I'll provide a contrast, but before I do, please don't take what I'm about to say as trying to diminish the nature of what we're dealing with this evening. That is not my intent. It is simply to provide a comparison. I believe that the violations that we're addressing tonight to be very serious, significant, and again, I would argue the $1.5 million is reflective of that. So to contrast to what we did with the sanitation districts, the city's sewage spills and the manner in which the city had been managing and operating its sewer system program, that resulted, contributed to 9 discharge incidents with more than 12.5 million gallons of raw sewage going to dry desert washes. And that happened over a time period of about 3.25 years. We do not have any documented impacts to beneficial uses or to water quality, but one could expect, and this is stated within the documents you have before you tonight, that there were temporary localized impacts to the underlying groundwater quality, most likely the municipal and domestic supply beneficial use for the groundwater and the wildlife habitat on the surface, that beneficial use, more than likely temporarily locally impacted. The 9 incidents also violated waste discharge requirements and basin plan waste discharge prohibitions. So that gives you, I would say, I don't see the nature of the city's discharges, while very significant and substantial, I don't see them rising in impact and effect to the level that the LA County Sanitation District discharges do. So that kind of like brings us from $11.7 million down to somewhere, in my opinion, below the 4.75. And this is spelled out in the documents, the ACL methodology that's part of our settlement agreement. Another thing that we look at is the action being effective? And there are a number of places where you can look to measure effectiveness or evaluate effectiveness. A key one is returning a discharger to compliance or returning to compliance. Key element of the state board's enforcement policy, definitely one of the top objectives, if not the top objective of the Lahontan Water Board's enforcement program. In this case, the city first committed to returning to compliance in writing in late May 2016. This was shortly after the State Water Board staff had released their report following the December 2015 inspection program audit, and it was prior to us issuing the ACL complaint in July 2016. And the city now has, or then was very busy in 2016 in that they updated their sewer system management plan, which is kind of the cornerstone of the State Board's general permit for public sanitary sewer systems. When they did that, they also addressed deficiencies that had been identified in its operation and maintenance program, its rehabilitation and replacement plan, its overflow emergency response plan, its system evaluation and capacity assurance plan, and its communication program, all key elements of the State Board permit. And in doing so, this returned the city to compliance with the permit's system evaluation, planning, and operational elements. But the city didn't stop there. That's a document. Then they got busy implementing the document. They hired additional staff. They purchased specialized equipment that not only allows them to respond to these isolated sites that have difficult access due to sand, a number of different conditions. They also purchased equipment that allows them to get out there and inspect these isolated, vulnerable locations on a more frequent basis. They now can also get out there and respond to these sites without having to first basically blade a road in to allow their equipment in. So the nature and extent of their discharges are decreasing as a result of these efforts. That also helps them maintain compliance. Also, they have spent millions, and they will spend millions more over the next few years on continuing to inspect, assess, maintain, and improve their sewer system. And this additional activity and these resources is what's going to allow them to maintain the compliance that they've returned to. And more so, and just as importantly, or if not more so, protects the area's valuable surface and groundwater resources. Another thing that we look to and evaluate effectiveness of an enforcement action is its deterrent value or effect. And I believe the $1.5 million liability is and will continue to be an effective deterrent for future violations by the city. I know they don't want to repeat any part of this process ever again, and by others. And that's what you're striving for when you're looking at deterrent. I'm not aware of any party in the region, maybe a couple of exceptions, that would consider this amount, liability amount, to be inconsequential and worth the risk. I think those that might have been considering, we'll cheat here, cheat there, they're back in the fold. And those that might be willing on the border, it's given them good cause to reconsider any act of noncompliance. The proposed settlement was also sent out to all public sewer system operators in this area. And I know and I'm confident that it made an impression upon everybody. I haven't heard it, but I'm confident that $1.5 million is a big enough hit on anybody's bottom line to take notice. And finally, another key element is eliminating economic benefit associated with the noncompliance, maintaining an even playing field for those that are complying with our state laws, regulations, and policies. The State Water Board's enforcement policy requires that the total liability or the recommended liability cover the economic benefit plus 10%. And this, as it's spelled out in the settlement documents, the $1.5 million covers the economic benefit plus 10% by almost $400,000, a little less than $400,000, if I did my math right. So we meet that. That helps us, as I said earlier, maintain that even level playing field for those that have been and continue to comply with the sanitary sewer general permit. So I think we have a fair, effective enforcement action that's before you today. I think it's going to help out a number of different people that have not been able to help themselves due to the financial impact, and I think we'll be helping out the environment also. So I think there's a strong case put forth on accepting this settlement agreement. However, You have other options. I will start with the one I like, which is accept the proposed settlement agreement as it's proposed. And I'll have one caveat I need to point out on that, but I'll catch that in a moment. The other one is you can reject the proposed settlement agreement. Now, that's not just a either or, because if you do reject it, you have more decisions you can make. It's rejection with conditions or direction. You can request the parties to make revisions, and we could evaluate, the city and the prosecution team could. I've seen it where that discussion happens in 15 minutes and we settle it and we're done. I've seen where we need a little more time and we can either come back or you direct the executive officer to run the rest of the process and we're successful. There is the potential we could come back to you and say we just can't do it. It's an unknown, but that's an option. You could reject it and direct the city and staff, prosecution team, to prepare and return before you for a contested public hearing. And that's where we would lay out all the facts as we have them, but it would be as if this had not happened. So, and then the other one is, you could say, you know what, we just don't think that this is rises to the level that an ACL is worthwhile, and you direct us to take no further action on this. That's another option. One other that I didn't put up there is you guys can always take more time to think it over. There's another one. We come back at a later date. You may have questions that we can't answer, what number of reasons you could go down that pathway. So those are the options. As I said earlier, the one I prefer, and I'm requesting, and the city's requesting you to do, is to accept the settlement agreement as it's proposed. The one minor exception, as I discovered, one minor error, and it's on Bates Stamp 6-74, paragraph C. Last sentence says the recommended liability amount would represent the third largest administrative civil liability imposed by the Lahontan Water Board. It actually is the fourth largest, but still adequately large to, as the rest of the sentence says, send a strong message that such violations are taken seriously by the Water Board and addressed accordingly. So.
Scott, can I clarify where that changes in the paragraph? You said the third paragraph or the second paragraph?
Paragraph C.
Paragraph C.
Last sentence. We're changing the word third to fourth.
Thank you.
And with that, I'd like to invite Keith Metzler, city manager for the city of Victorville, to come up and share some of his thoughts. Thank you.
Thank you, Scott. Good evening, Chair Pumphrey, and distinguished members of the board and prosecution team. I'm Keith Metzler. I'm the city manager of the city of Victorville. Thank you for giving me this opportunity to speak before you this evening and to represent the city of Victorville and our city council. Joining me this evening is our city engineer, and I'll ask them to stand up so they can be recognized as our city engineer, Brian Gengler, just over my left. Mr. Doug Matthews, he's our director of public works, and our city attorney, Andre DeBortnowski. They're here to help us answer any questions you may have of us. I'd like to begin by saying thank you to the board and to the prosecution team for the opportunity to work cooperatively with you on this settlement agreement. We believe it is a fair settlement agreement. In particular, I'd like to thank Lahontan staff member Scott Ferguson and Laura Drabrant for a very detailed and thorough investigation and evaluation of the contributing factors that led to our ACL. Because of their commitment to detail, we're able to put together an effective action plan to improve the management of our sewer system and to mitigate risk well into the future. Above all else, I'd like to communicate to you the City of Victorville's earnest commitment to preserving, enhancing, and restoring the quality of water resources and drinking water in California and in our local community. The City of Victorville, if you don't know, operates a sanitary system, a sanitary sewer collection system that serves approximately 96,800 residents in a 74-square-mile service area. Our system consists of 437 miles of gravity lines with 7 pump stations and approximately 8,687 manholes. Additionally, there are about 28,000 sanitary sewer laterals in our city. For your consideration this evening is a settlement agreement for the ACL issued in July of 2016. As a brief recap of the history leading up to this point, in September 2015, we experienced a sanitary sewer overflow in one of our more remote washes. Regrettably, this overflow went undetected for 9 days, resulting in discharge of approximately 11.5 million gallons. Vandalism, unfortunately, was determined to be the root cause of this particular SSO. 3 months later, in December of 2015, Water Board staff performed a compliance inspection of the city's sewer collection system. The compliance inspection report available in February of 2016 noted several deficiencies in the City of Victorville SSMP, or Sewer System Management Plan, and identified information on additional SSOs. As a result, in July of 2016, the Water Board issued an administrative civil liability complaint against Victorville in the amount of $6.3 million, listing 6 SSOs and failure to properly manage, operate, and maintain all parts of our sanitary sewer system. We have taken very seriously the board's recommendations, and since 2016, we have worked closely with Lahontan staff to undertake a very ambitious array of improvements to our sewer utility that demonstrate not only our commitment to mitigate your concerns, but also to responsibly manage our sewer system in order to protect and preserve our precious water resources for the benefit of our ratepayers into the future. I'd like to outline a few of the more significant actions here. We updated our SSMP in December of 2016. Next, we invested $4.2 million to have our sewer system cleaned and visually inspected. During this study, 8,463 pipe segments were evaluated and coded for observed defects. An engineering consultant prepared a condition assessment report with recommendations for rehabilitation projects. This became the basis for our sewer system capital improvement program. And I've actually seen the results of those visual inspections. We've actually been able to, with those inspections, using the camera and the video, actually been able to keep that in our computer system at City Hall. It's something that effectively serves as our baseline characterization of what the pipelines or what the pipes look like internally. And every year, especially as we continue to go and do our recurring inspections, we actually have now baseline video detail to compare against to see if there's any changes in conditions on the inner walls of the pipeline. We also lined 11,390 lineal feet of sewer mains in 10 different locations. This process added strength to these pipes and significantly extended their usable life. This project was complete in January of 2018 at a cost of $321,000. Additional sewer lining projects are currently planned. Also in 2018, the Victorville City Council approved new sewer rates, which provide an adequate funding source for us to correct deficiencies and to properly maintain and manage our system well into the future. Currently, we're in the process of replacing close to 8,000 feet of deficient sewer main in 11 locations. This project is approximately 90% complete, and we estimate it to its completion at the end of April for a cost of another $1.9 million. In the coming months, we'll undertake $4.4 million project to replace and realign nearly 6,000 feet of sewer mains on Code Road, right at Hesperia Road. We estimate this project be complete by the end of August of this calendar year. On the horizon, and we don't stop there, on the horizon, we have three more projects planned to upgrade more than 11,000 feet of sewer main for a total cost of approximately $5.2 million. Because vandalism was the cause of several of our SSOs, including the large SSO that occurred in September of 2015, we've also instituted several proactive measures to mitigate the risk of vandalism and to detect SSOs quicker should they occur. These measures include better manhole security, visual inspections, and advanced warning detection systems. We've also improved communication with our treatment facility to receive notification of abnormal flows more quickly so that we can address future SSOs much more quickly. When combined, the improvements I've outlined here total approximately $16 million, an investment into our sewer system. This doesn't include a multitude of staff training and public outreach and education through our FOG program. By listing all these actions tonight, I intend to demonstrate to you how seriously the City of Victorville has taken your concerns, as well as our commitment to adhering to your prescribed standards in order to protect our water supply. With that, I thank you for your consideration.
Thank you very much. I do not have any speaker cards, so I have no one to call on, but is there anyone who has not filled out a speaker card but is here this evening and wishes to speak to this agenda item? If there is not, I would then turn to board questions and discussion. I would note that in addition to the board, members of the advisory team may ask questions with respect to the proposed settlement as well. So I think I will start and ask if any member of the advisory board wishes to ask any question at this time.
This is Patty Kuyum-Jen. I do not have any questions. I think many of the questions we asked are included in the questions we asked the prosecution team and parties earlier in your packet.
Thank you.
Board Chair, if I may, I have just one minor question.
Yes, ma'am.
The change presented by Scott Ferguson seems to be a minor change, but just wanted to confirm whether or not the City of Victorville was in favor of that change, since they didn't speak on that matter.
Andre DeBornowski, City Attorney. We are completely okay with that change.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Mr. Jardine, any questions?
No questions from myself nor staff.
Mr. Sandell, any questions?
I have a comment, which is that this is a remarkable turnaround. It's virtually biblical in its immensity. Congratulations to staff and to the city, too, for the really a huge amount of work. I only had one question, really, and that was I was puzzled that this was, it seemed that the report, the compliance inspection was not done by our staff, and I wanted to know why was that? Why wouldn't that be something that we would do routinely?
Scott Ferguson, Supervising Water Resource Control Engineer. This is where, given the complexities, it went beyond, I guess, the complexities and the breadth of evaluating a full sewer system operations and maintenance program at the city level. We thought it would be beneficial to bring in additional support from the State Water Board. They have conducted these types of audits, which do a much deeper dive. They have greater experience with doing so. And so we tapped into that area of expertise and we participated
that.
With it. And then they wrote up the report. So it was where that's the basic reason, is that we saw an opportunity to draw upon other staff's experience in such matters, and thought it was prudent to do so.
Okay, I just wanted to be sure that it was we who initiated.
One moment, Mr. Sandell, we've lost your sound.
I just wanted to be sure that it was us that initiated that.
Yes, it was at our request.
Great. Well, this is a great effort. I support it. I'm ready to vote.
Thank you.
And I too, Don.
Any questions, Mr. Dias?
Yes, thank you. First of all, I think the SEP, or the Supplemental Environmental Project chosen, was a very good one. Anytime you can remove 33 on-site wastewater treatment systems, you're obviously going to improve groundwater quality. But I'm just curious as to whether we had any monitoring wells in the vicinity that would indicate what the groundwater quality looked like at this time.
Scott Ferguson, Supervising Water Resource Control Engineer. I'm not aware of any groundwater monitoring wells other than that might be associated with some site cleanup projects in the area. But we have not done any monitoring to see what pre-SEP conditions are at this point.
Okay. One more question. I believe Mr. Metzler indicated that 96,000 residents are currently served by the sanitary sewer system, and I wonder how many are not served. In other words, what's the current population of the city?
Current population is about 125,000.
Okay.
Current population is about 125,000.
Okay, thank you. No more questions.
Questions, Dr. Horn.
Thank you, Chair. First of all, I want to echo Mr. Sandell's comments that this is a really remarkable turnaround, and I congratulate the City of Victorville for the hard work that has been done to make that happen. I have a few questions. I'm going to start with the most specific first and work up to the big picture questions. First of all, I was struck in reading a number of the incidents that once a discharge was discovered, the response was to create berms to try to contain the flow and to collect it, but the percentage that of the discharge that was collected was very small. And it just perplexed me. That seems an inadequate response when there's a discharge. Is there a more effective approach to use?
Thank you and good evening. Doug Matthews, City of Victorville, Public Works and Water Director. The short answer to that is we have very sandy soil in many of these areas, and they're wash areas. So the first goal is to contain, stop the overflow, make it safe for the citizens, and then go try and collect anything that's been bermed. Generally, by the time we get to that, it's already gone into the ground.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Well, another question is, there was a write-up in here about smart manholes being installed, and that there were pictures of a number of manholes that now have bolts on them to prevent vandalism. sort of what percentage of manhole covers are now smart manholes or bolted versus ones that are still, that could potentially be vandalized?
I honestly don't have a number on that percentage, but two different issues here. The smart manhole covers detect flow rising in the manhole. We place those at strategic locations where okay. we've had issues and where it will possibly be at the point where it can detect an SSO occurring. But if it's on the wrong side of it, it won't do it. So you partially have to be lucky, but partially strategic with those. I think that the bigger factor is having the flow alarms with our local wastewater treatment authority to be able to monitor what's going on down there. And as far as bolted manhole covers and straps, we're aggressively pursuing those first in the outlying areas because that's where the vandalism has seemed to occur.
Right.
But the goal is to eventually get them all retrofitted or bolted.
Okay, great. Thank you. But as your comment, I mean, I'm just going to make a comment. You don't need to stay up here. That the soils are sandy. Yes, they are. And that makes it, I think, even more imperative to prevent these discharges in the first place.
And if I could add one comment on there.
Sure.
My staff has really been made aware, go collect something. I mean, it's a paramount objective out there to try and get something if we can. So when it occurs in areas that aren't so sandy, if it's in some type of a concrete area or something like that, we certainly are able to recover it.
Sure, yeah.
Dr. Horn, can I add one more thing on that issue? With a number of those discharge incidents, Mr. Metzler alluded to it that several of them occurred for a significant time period before they were discovered. And so that also contributes to how much you put that, where it's occurring for a time period, that's going to decrease your recovery percentage. And the other thing was they've purchased equipment, the city has, which allows them to get out there and do some additional recovery equipment that they couldn't get out into these sandy areas mm-hmm. as easily.
Mm-hmm.
So they have taken steps. Will it be perfect? No. Will you see a better percent recovery? I think so.
Mm-hmm.
So steps have been taken to mitigate, but it is, you're battling very sandy soils.
Right, right. Don't go away. I got questions for you.
Of course.
I, for the life of me, could not figure out how you got the factor 2A, the 0.22 and the 0.31.
Oh.
I studied those tables, and I multiplied things back and forth, and I could not for the life of me figure out how you got those numbers. So could you please explain it to me?
You want to work with an example?
Sure.
Sure.
What bait stamp are you on?
I just turned magically to bait stamp 6-67.
Okay.
So, as you see, it's like a 10-step process.
Right.
It'll drive you to a 12-step process. But the first part, step one.
No, I got step one.
You got step one, which step?
It's step 2A, the
0.22. Oh, extent of deviation?
Yeah.
From the requirement?
Right.
Okay. So you take that and I wish I had the policy in front of me. You got the policy in front? Oh, yeah, like I can read that.
I could not find 0.22 anywhere on those tables.
Oh, there it is. I see it. So what you do is you take the potential from harm.
Sorry to interrupt. There is a prior version of the policy, which might be the one that you're not looking at. It's a 2010 versus the 2017 policy. We're looking at the 2010 policy and the tables within that policy.
I think that explains it because I was pulling up the one that was online.
Yeah.
Okay.
Excuse me, for the record, that's David Boyers, for those in Tahoe cannot see him. So if we could remember to introduce ourselves for our folks in Tahoe. Thank you.
Okay, question answered. Thank you.
Thank you, David.
That was easy. Too easy. I'm going to come up with harder questions now. Sorry. I had a feeling that the factor 4C, which was often 1.0, 1.0, 1.0, neutral, in other words, was too low. I mean, it was the maximum there. I mean, we're talking a minor difference. The maximum, if there are repeat violations, it can go up to 1.1. And so the first one, obviously, was not a repeat violation, the 89,000 gallons. But all the ones after that were, and I just did a back-of-the-envelope calculation that if you used 1.1 for all the rest of them, you come up with about $13 million. So that's a bigger number.
Well, I'll explain. So history of violations is not as simple as it sounds. Like you said, you have one, no history. You have two, you have history. You have the first one, right? That seems very straightforward. The way that's put into practice is until you have an adjudicated process completed, so like we complete this process, these are just alleged violations out there. They haven't been put before the board, evaluated, and stuff. So simply having three spills does not mean you have a history of three spills does not constitute a history of violation of the two previous, because you're dealing with alleged violations. You got to go through the adjudicated process in order to have a history of violations. So trust me, back in the day, we went through the same thing, had the same quandary.
Okay.
And had the same discussions, and this is where it's come to how it's practiced.
So after working with great detail through steps 1 through 5, we come up with a bunch of numbers, and then there's steps 6 through 10, or 12, as you say, although I only saw 10.
No, there's only 10. It drives you to a 12-step process.
All right. Now, wait, 613, why isn't it, am I in the wrong?
That section begins on Bait Stamp 670. This is Elizabeth.
Now, I say here, raw sewage. I'm taking myself to a bait stamp that doesn't show what I thought I was going to find there. So it has to do with the constituents of, that the constituents of raw sewage, which have pathogens, and oftentimes you don't even know what's in there because household chemicals could be in it and all kinds of other stuff. Compared with what was happening with LICSD was secondary treated sewage.
Correct.
Now, were they operating within a permit, LICSD?
Yes, they had, both facilities had their own waste discharge requirements, permits.
Okay, so they were within their permit.
Well, but they were cited for violations of their permit, which subsequently led to formal enforcement actions, cease and desist orders, a cleanup and abatement order, and then eventually the settlement.
It just seems to me there's a significant difference in risk factor between the raw sewage discharges here and the secondary treated sewage of LACSD.
Well, I would say there's differences, and I think what you're referring to is the toxicity, potential for harm toxicity element. What happened with Los Angeles County Sanitation District 20, Palmdale, is that's the waste discharge that resulted in the nitrate pollution, groundwater pollution, above the drinking water. So that was the key element there. You're right. Sewage, raw sewage, has a lot of unknowns, but we identified it, I believe, fairly high up in the toxicity value range. to reflect that.
I had a dyslexic moment. So, yeah, the text says elevated concentrations of biological oxygen demand, total suspend solids, high levels of pathogens, viruses, and bacteria, which are sort of important these days, toxic pollutants, heavy metals, pesticides, personal care products, and pharmaceuticals. Yeah, so... Yeah, factor two could go. Factor two, sorry. Step one could go from 0 to 4, and you gave it 3 in most places. So yeah, that was.
I think we probably gave it consistently 3 because it's what's it's not to the quantity or anything like that. It's just what is the stuff.
Yeah, but still. I still say what LACSD was doing was, because it was secondary treated effluent that it was being discharged, was not as serious as what was going on here. So your comparison of the two, I think, is maybe not apt.
I admitted when I put that comparison together that it was not, I'll say oranges to oranges. I was thinking today maybe it's oranges to tangerines, navel to mandarin. But anyways, the fact it was the nature, there's still
kumquat
the nature
to
that the bottom line is I'm still looking at the number of violations or the length of violations leading up to issuing the settlement agreement. I'm looking at the actual documented impacts to the municipal and domestic supply beneficiary use. That this one resulted, that LA Sanitation District 20 resulted in. I'm looking at the fact that they violated 3 of this board's formal enforcement actions along the way. Those are all things above and beyond what we're dealing with here with the city.
Okay.
That's what I was trying to point out.
All
the
right.
fact that 2007, so 13 years later, we still have water. That is above the MCL.
Yes, I know.
Even
I'm
though
not
they've,
happy about it.
Even though they've done everything that we would want them to
right.
do. Shy
okay. About documented
tree.
Violations, there are we don't have documented violations here, isn't it true? Because those things weren't measured.
Correct. We did not. Right. We did not like pop a well right down there to see if the groundwater, to what extent it was impacted. What we can say, and is documented in the settlement documents, that none of our municipal supply wells, public municipal supply wells, that are across, that were in closest proximity to any of these discharges, registered any impact from the discharges. That's what we have. But I'm not going about it blindly either, as because, as I said, in the settlement documents, it's likely, it should be expected that that shallow groundwater got hit by raw sewage with its pathogens, with its nutrients, with its toxic whatever. So I'm not putting my head in that sand.
Yeah.
I'm acknowledging it.
In other cases we have, we are concerned with potential impacts, whether or not they've occurred.
Mm-hmm.
And with 11 million gallons of raw sewage on the surface of the land, I mean, there is a potential for human exposure to those pathogens and virus. So I don't really see what the difference is here. Why the potential for exposure to REC 1, REC 2, beneficial uses isn't there.
Why we didn't highlight those beneficial uses?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
The city certainly seems to have ability to pay that factor. There was plenty of money there cited. And then, I mean, after going through this very detailed calculation, factors step one, A, B, and C, step two, A, B, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Then there seemed to be a lot of hand-waving right at the end about what's fair, what's comparison, what's... And suddenly we go from a proposed ACL of $6 million in 2016 to a quarter of that 4 years later after 500,000 more gallons of raw sewage have been discharged. And that doesn't feel right to me.
Well, going back, I said through the settlement talks, additional information was provided. So on the violation related to not going out and cleaning up after a spill quickly and adequately, that one accounted for, I should bring it up on my computer, I had it.
Which spill number was that?
This is going back to the ACL methodology, or this is going back to the ACL complaint. So
okay.
This is violation number
seven. Oh, seven.
Which was dropped.
Oh, okay.
So that represented $1.76 million of that 6.3. I think that's what it was. So the 6.3.
Okay.
So we're going back to the ACL complaint now.
Right.
And that represented a... What I looked at was what was the percentage... What's that?
Let me just ask them. Sure. Sorry to interrupt, Scott. David Boyers. So that 1.7 reflected one of the eight violations that was alleged in the complaint. Now, the complaint, once you went through the methodology, came up with $15 million.
Mm.
And then it reduced that $15 million down to $6.3 million. So mm-hmm. It's not actually 1.7 of the 6.3. It's 1.7 of the 15 that was then reduced using other factors. It was a different thought process and a different methodology because we did have those two separate violations, those non-discharge violations. And so we were looking at $15 million.
Okay.
So it's a difficult comparison to make.
Okay.
But Scott is correct. Of the $15 million, it was 1.7.
All right. Thank you. And then one of the principles of SEPs is we can't ask the discharger to do something that they were otherwise required to do, right?
Correct.
So in this case, what the final number is basically requiring the discharger to pay money they should have already paid in order to do the things that we've asked them to do, and there's no inflation factor in there either. So it just feels like the amount just kind of went down to some, a small percentage of what was originally proposed. And it didn't feel, I couldn't follow the logic of that.
I'm not sure I understand that you're saying that, going back to your original statement here, that they're paying.
Okay. So the cost savings.
Yes.
All right. So the amount is basically cost savings plus 10% and sort of very close to that number, right? Is the total amount proposed.
Right, by chance.
But it's money they should have been spending anyway, and there's no inflation factor in there.
No, there actually is, and it's more than just going, oh, you should have bought this truck for this amount, blah, blah, blah. There is actually the time value of money is worked into it, and that time value of money was worked into the whole economic analysis starting back at the beginning of the first discharge, back in March of 2014.
Okay.
Actually, it kept getting we had come to agreement on the 1.5, And when we first started it, we were good with the economic benefit. But as time progresses, because of the account for the time value of money, and time just plodding along as we're going through the process, that economic benefit continuing to go up, up, mm-hmm. up, and it went up quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
So it is accounted for. It takes into account that by not spending money back in 2000, that they could put that money to work for them and make more money off of it, make it do other things. That's all taken into consideration in the economic benefit analysis. It's not just looking at what was the cost of a truck back here, what's the cost of, even with the staff, there's a inflation factor in there.
Scott and board member, if I may, I also wanted to address the comment about the statement that the SEP can't require a project that is already required to be conducted by the discharger, and that's true. Here, the city, there is no requirement for the city to hook up these septic systems to sewer.
No, I know that. I'm making an analogy between that principle and the amount of money being spent.
I just wanted to add that clarification.
Right.
Thank you.
Well, another back-of-the-envelope calculation I did was, what if all 54 residences in the disadvantaged community were hooked up? And using a sort of round number of $30,000 per, I came up with $1.6 million would get all those residences hooked up. So given that the total amount seems to have been reduced below what I think it should be, and that with a higher amount, all of the residences in the disadvantaged community could be covered, I think there's an argument to be made for a higher amount.
Okay. Just to put that into perspective, and you've probably already done this math, but given the rules of how much of a SEP, how much of the total liability, so then you would be looking at 3.2,
right,
roughly.
Although we have gotten a dispensation in the past to spend more than 50% on a SEP, so that's also possible.
Correct. I think once before. Much smaller SEP.
True. Okay. That's all my questions.
Okay. Thank you very much.
I have no questions. The chair would entertain a motion to either approve or reject the proposed settlement.
I'll make a motion that we accept the proposed settlement agreement.
Is there a second?
Don seconds the motion.
Any comments, Mr. Jardine?
No comments.
Mr. Sandell?
The only comment I have, as a matter of curiosity, how much was the total discharge for LACSD, for Palmdale and Lancaster over the course of their polluting days compared to
huge,
this?
Huge.
I'm thinking it's in the billions.
No, it's true.
Scott Ferguson, you're probably right, Mr. Sandell. You're looking at billions of gallons. That's why I threw out, just for comparison, that the treatment capacities for each facility, one being 16 million gallons per day and the other being 15 million gallons per day. Not that they were necessarily operating at those levels, but...
Yeah, but just one day's worth of treatment compared to what's happened here.
Correct.
Yeah.
Before I ask for additional comments, Mr. Diaz, I want to make sure that your motion to approve the proposed settlement includes the one change that was alluded to by Mr. Ferguson, changing the designation from the third to the fourth.
My motion does include the change we made during this hearing.
Mr. Jardine, does that affect your second in any way?
No, I agree.
Thank you. Comment, Mr. Dias?
No comments, but I do appreciate Board Member Sandell's question putting the total discharges into consideration.
Comments, Dr. Horn?
No comments.
I have no comments. Mr. Jardine?
Aye.
Mr. Sandell?
Aye.
Mr. Dias?
Aye.
Dr. Horn?
No.
I vote aye. That concludes item 6 on the agenda. I believe that concludes our business for today, and we will reconvene here tomorrow morning at 8:30. Thank you all for joining us. See you in the morning.